Welcome to The Deep Dive, the show where we extract the essential knowledge from the world's most critical documents and source materials.
We synthesize the complex, connect the dots, and really provide the context so that you, the listener, get a thorough and efficient understanding of the day's most significant shifts.
And today, we are dedicating this entire deep dive to the content contained within the Wall Street Journal for Saturday, September 27th, 2025. I'm Alex Vanderbilt, and I'll be your guide leading us through these, well, pretty high-stakes headlines.
And I'm Sam Astor, ready to help analyze the underlying mechanics and, you know, the long-term implications of these stories. And taken together, they really capture a fascinating moment of tension.
Yeah, looking at the full scope of this paper, the overriding theme seems to be the sheer, well, the cost of ambition. You see these colossal financial moves, massive political risk-taking.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, kind of paradoxically, there's this distinct layer of consumer caution just sort of holding steady underneath it all.
Absolutely. The market is showing this immense appetite for scale, for stability and control, especially when that control means taking a major company out of the public eye, you know, away from that quarterly scrutiny.
Right.
And that brings us straight to the biggest business play in today's paper. Video game giant Electronic Arts. EA is nearing a roughly $50 billion deal to go private.
$50 billion. I mean, that's almost unbelievable. Such a huge valuation. It sets a stunning precedent, doesn't it, for private equity in the entertainment world?
It really does.
We're talking about one of the, you know, foundational giants of gaming. What does this tell us about the state of the industry and maybe more importantly, the mindset of private capital right now?
It's a huge flashing signal, really. It shows that private capital sees the established gaming sector as a source of highly stable, recurring, long-term returns.
Mm.
I mean, EA is anchored by incredibly sticky IP.
Like their sports games.
Exactly. Think FIFA, Madden.
Yeah.
Those titles essentially guarantee revenue streams. You've got subscriptions, in-game spending, microtransactions. It's all there.
Oh.
So by taking a firm, this massive private, the investment group can basically de-risk the company from the volatility, the short-term earnings pressure you get in the public markets.
So it's like that stability that comes from having a captive global digital audience,
yeah,
that's actually more valuable to a private buyer who's willing to pay a premium,
mm-hmm,
than it is to the public stock market, which might be looking more for, I don't know, disruptive growth.
Precisely. They're betting on the reliable cash flow from those established platforms. It lets them focus on maybe massive restructuring or long-term product development without the public markets, you know, yelling about quarterly misses.
Yeah.
It definitely reflects a growing trend. When a business model matures and stabilizes its cash generation, like gaming has, private equity sees immense value in owning the whole machine, just away from all the noise.
Okay. Speaking of colossal spending, the other financial behemoth just dominating the conversation today is artificial intelligence. Mm-hmm. We've got this article asking you a really crucial, maybe even terrifying question. Spending on AI, is it epic levels? Will it ever pay off?
Mm-hmm.
What does epic levels actually mean in practical terms, like beyond just being a big number?
Yeah, it mainly refers to the sheer scale of the CapEx race,
right?
Capital expenditure, right? The money being poured into the foundational infrastructure.
Okay.
And we're not just talking software licenses here. We're discussing tens, maybe hundreds of billions being spent globally on the actual physical assets required. You know, the specialized NVIDIA chips, building these massive climate-controlled data centers,
right,
and the energy infrastructure needed just to power the training of these huge foundational models.
That sounds like a necessary investment if AI really is the future, but the article asks if it will pay off, which, you know, inherently suggests the market's worried. Are we in a bubble driven by FOMO, fear of missing out, or are we maybe over-investing in infrastructure that could become obsolete really quickly? What's the thinking there?
It's definitely a tension between, you know, necessary build out and maybe speculative excess. The paper suggests the payoff might not be immediate. It might not even be visible directly to the consumer right away. And if we connect this to another article later in the paper, the virtual worlds where AI is making its next big leap, that gives us a pretty crucial clue.
Uh-huh.
The real value, it seems, is expected to be unlocked in these highly specialized closed enterprise environments. Things like synthetic data generation, complex manufacturing simulations, digital testing, prototyping grounds, that sort of thing.
Right.
So the CapEx, the spending, is for the underlying capacity. And the payoff comes when businesses can cut physical waste and development time by using these virtual environments.
But if that massive infrastructure build out, if it fails to deliver those immediate high margin enterprise profits.
Mm-hmm.
What's the downside risk? Do we just see a big correction focused on the infrastructure providers, or does the whole tech economy kind of feel a chill?
Well, if those immediate applications don't materialize fast enough, the downside is you've got immense capacity just sitting idle. That leads to asset write-downs, for sure. We'd certainly see a correction in the valuations of like the cloud providers and the chip manufacturers who built all this capacity. But critically, it could also stifle the next wave of AI startups, the ones who depend on cheap, abundant compute power to innovate. So yeah, the whole tech ecosystem is kind of holding its breath, waiting for this infrastructure to monetize.
Okay, let's shift a bit now from AI spending to political spending and influence.
Yeah.
Tariffs are back in the spotlight. There's this question. Will Trump's new tariffs spur U.S. production? And the answer seems to be, well, it's complicated. It seems highly segmented, acting like a selective economic force, especially within the pharmaceutical industry.
That's exactly the key takeaway. These tariffs are not hitting everyone the same way. The headline spells it out pretty clearly. Big pharma unfazed by Trump tariffs, but small biotechs face vulnerability.
And we see an immediate, very tangible response from one of the big players that really illustrates this. Amgen, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
They're moving to invest $650 million in U.S. production expansion as Trump hikes tariffs. That $650 million investment looks like a direct, calculated response to the changed economic math caused by trade policy.
And that's precisely the kind of strategic reaction that only the mega firms can really afford, right? They can absorb temporary tariff costs, or like Amgen's doing, they can treat the tariffs as a permanent cost of doing business and just pivot their supply chain investment domestically.
Okay.
But now consider the smaller biotechs. They often rely on these highly specialized, maybe single-source global supply chains. They operate on razor-thin margins, often sustained by venture capital.
Yeah.
For them, tariffs introduce an immediate, potentially existential cost increase. They just can't mitigate that with a $500 million domestic investment plan. It's just not feasible.
And layered on top of the tariffs, the pharma sector is under renewed political pressure about drug pricing itself. We see AstraZeneca stepping up to offer discounted drugs as Trump pressures pharma industry to cut prices. It's sort of a fascinating two-pronged attack, isn't it?
It really is.
One hand uses tariffs to maybe incentivize manufacturing shifts, and the other uses executive pressure to demand lower costs for consumers.
It forces the major pharma companies onto this incredibly difficult tightrope. They're simultaneously being told invest hundreds of millions domestically, which obviously increases their production costs,
yes,
while also being politically compelled to reduce prices. This dynamic fundamentally shifts the risk calculation for future drug development and, frankly, profitability in the U.S. market.
Now, while Wall Street seems to be doing okay, stocks rise.
Mm-hmm.
After investors brush off sticky inflation and tariffs, there's this persistent cloud of caution kind of hanging over the everyday person. We see the news that consumer sentiment fell in September, according to the University of Michigan survey.
And this is the critical disconnect, the one that matters for the broader economy. Wall Street's driven by corporate earnings, asset valuations. They can weather tariffs if big firms like Amgen pivot effectively.
Mm-hmm.
But the WUM survey captures the mood of consumers, people who are facing persistent, sticky inflation, meaning the overall price levels for goods and services just aren't coming down significantly.
Yeah.
So when people feel their dollar isn't going as far, their sentiment dips. It doesn't matter what the Dow is doing.
So if consumer sentiment falls, that generally forecasts a future slowdown in,
yeah,
like major discretionary purchases. Things like cars, new appliances, big home renovations.
Mm-hmm.
Even if people aren't outright panicking, it suggests maybe a pause.
Precisely. It's a signal of tightening the belt. It shows that all this political and economic friction, from tariffs that could raise import costs to drug pricing battles that maybe raise healthcare anxiety, it's translating directly into cautious behavior on Main Street. And that acts as a brake on potential economic acceleration.
Okay, so let's maybe unpack this shift now from that financial anxiety to the political volatility, which really dominates the paper's A section today. The coverage is overwhelmingly focused on these domestic legal battles, executive power struggles, specifically surrounding what the journal calls the Comey-Trump cycle.
Yeah, this political narrative seems to be accelerating rapidly. It's moving from just a legal skirmish to what looks like a declared strategy. The articles detail how Trump overcame internal dissent to get his case against Comey.
That's a crucial detail, isn't it? It suggests the legal pursuit was maybe deeply personalized, potentially politically risky, requiring mobilizing executive will against internal opposition to even proceed.
Exactly. And then the stakes were immediately raised, just about as high as possible, when Trump pledges that others will be indicted after Comey.
Wow.
This transforms a single legal case into basically a declared political strategy. He's essentially promising a broader campaign of legal action against perceived political rivals or opponents.
The Journal frames this whole dynamic as the Comey-Trump revenge cycle, suggesting this sort of perpetual loop where political scores are increasingly settled through the justice system, maybe instead of the ballot box.
Right. And we also see a supporting opinion piece that takes a pretty dramatic rhetorical swing, arguing that Comey is worse than a criminal, calling him a blunderer. This reinforces the narrative that the prosecution isn't just about specific legal technicalities, but it's framed as being about accountability for perceived profound political errors and, well, incompetence.
This intense focus on the use of executive power, or maybe its expansion, is mirrored by a massive win for the current administration of the Supreme Court. Supreme Court allows Trump to withhold $4 billion in foreign aid. This seems less about the specifics of the case and more about establishing a precedent for presidential authority over the budget, right?
It's absolutely a landmark ruling. It affirms presidential authority to unilaterally delay or effectively impound funds that Congress has appropriated, provided the administration argues it serves some overriding foreign policy objective.
And that's a big deal historically.
Oh, yeah. Historically, Congress has fought fiercely against that kind of impoundment. So this $4 billion ruling represents a tremendous confirmation of executive power in this area.
And the specific amount, $4 billion.
Yeah.
That's highly consequential right now, isn't it? Especially internationally. What's the likely reaction from allies or organizations who are, you know, counting on those funds?
$4 billion is a significant pressure point. For the recipients, it means critical programs could be immediately halted or postponed. They're forced to rapidly realign their budgets, maybe their diplomatic positions.
Right.
For allies, it creates immense uncertainty. It makes them question the reliability of U.S. commitments. It fundamentally changes the balance of diplomatic power, really. The president now has a much more flexible tool to reward or punish foreign nations without needing explicit legislative approval every single time.
Meanwhile, the ongoing drama in D.C. continues with the shutdown standoff. We see the headline, Schumer sees an exit ramp in standoff over shutdown.
Mm.
What exactly defines that exit ramp, and what are the key sticking points that keep driving us back to this cliff edge again and again?
The exit ramp almost invariably means a temporary solution. Usually a short-term continuing resolution, a CR, that just funds the government for a few more weeks or maybe months.
Kicking the can down the road?
Pretty much. The underlying sticking points remain constant. Usually disagreements over funding levels for, say, border security, specific military or foreign aid packages, and often contentious policy riders that one side insists on attaching to the must-pass legislation. It's become perpetual governance by temporary crisis resolution.
Okay, let's pivot now, quite sharply, to global tensions. America's strategy and influence seem to be getting tested on multiple really crucial fronts. Let's start with the increasingly complicated position of Israel. Netanyahu says Israel's critics cave to pressure as his isolation deepens.
Yeah, the depth of this isolation is really key to understanding the political dynamics there. It refers to the growing diplomatic distance, the friction, not just from adversaries, but from traditional allies, too.
Including European nations.
Yes, some European nations and even key elements within the U.S. government, it's largely due to the prolonged conflict and the lack of clarity about post-war planning.
Okay.
So Netanyahu's statement that critics caved is really a domestic political deflection. He's trying to frame international disagreement not as a moral or strategic failure on Israel's part, but as a failure of foreign actors to withstand pressure from, quote, hostile elements.
We also see potentially massive shifts in U.S. foreign policy regarding Ukraine. Trump told Zelensky he was open to providing new long-range weapons, officials say. If that were implemented, that would represent a significant escalation, a major strategic shift in military support.
It raises the stakes substantially. Current aid packages often restrict the range and targeting capabilities of the weapons provided.
Right, there have been limits.
Exactly. Long-range weapons, things like ADCMS or maybe specialized air-launched munitions, they would allow Ukraine to strike command and control centers, logistical hubs, airfields much deeper behind Russian lines. That could fundamentally disrupt Russian offensive capability and strategy.
So even just the signal is a big shift.
The signal alone is a massive shift, yes. And implementation would be a concrete change from the more constrained military aid policies of previous administrations.
And the U.S. is also apparently wading into post-war governance planning for Gaza. The headline, Trump plan backs Tony Blair as post-war Gaza leader. Why Tony Blair, of all people? And what would a role like that actually entail?
Well, Blair, as the former UK Prime Minister, he carries an established international profile, and he has a deep, though certainly controversial, diplomatic history in the Middle East. He served as a Quartet envoy years ago.
Right, I remember that.
So the proposed leadership role would likely focus on stabilizing civil governance, coordinating massive humanitarian aid efforts, managing complex reconstruction projects, and maybe establishing security protocols separate from both Hamas and Israel.
Hmm.
The choice of Blair signals a desire for a figure with established global recognition, though actually implementing that remains, you know, highly complex.
While the U.S. is navigating all these conflicts, China seems to be employing a really fascinating, maybe highly effective dual strategy globally. On one hand, we have China's premier outlines deeper commitment to UN, presenting Beijing as this responsible global partner.
Hmm.
But then simultaneously, the opinion section counters with America is losing its ability to deter China.
That dual strategy is classic projection management by Beijing. Globally, they use established multilateral institutions like the UN to project soft power, cooperation, stability, leveraging their economic might.
Okay.
Regionally, however, particularly in the South China Sea with Taiwan and in their cyber operations, they aggressively push territorial and technological boundaries. The erosion of U.S. deterrence ability means that America's capacity to influence China's regional actions through the threat of cost or reprisal, economic or military, is demonstrably waning. And that makes Beijing bolder.
Europe, meanwhile, is dealing with some immediate physical security breaches. Suspected Russian drone incursions expose gaps in NATO defenses. This feels like an urgent reality check for the alliance, doesn't it?
It absolutely underscores the shift in modern warfare. These incursions highlight significant vulnerabilities, not just along border regions, but in the internal airspace surveillance and rapid response protocols for these small, non-conventional, often inexpensive drone threats.
So NATO defenses weren't built for this?
Historically, they were geared toward detecting jets or ballistic missiles, right? Not swarms of low-flying, maybe even commercial-grade drones. This demands an urgent, massive modernization of air defense architecture across all the Eastern European member states.
Separately, the EU is making proactive moves on the trade front. They're aiming to lock in three more trade deals in Asia by 2027, top official says. This shows a determined effort by Europe to forge economic ties, maybe independent of the often volatile shifts in U.S. trade policy.
It really demonstrates the EU's global trade strategy. It's centered on diversification and proactive engagement. They're strategically targeting these rapidly growing Asian markets to secure favorable terms for European goods and services, enhance their economic relevance, and reduce reliance on any single trading partner.
Hedging their bets.
Exactly. It's a calculated move to hedge against global protectionism, including potential future tariff actions from the U.S.
Okay, finally, in the world section, we see defiance from Tehran. Iran's president defiant as sanctions set to return. What's the core of their defiant position regarding this renewed international pressure?
Their defiance seems to stem from a rejection of the legitimacy of the renewed sanctions. They consistently frame them as illegal economic warfare designed to cripple their internal population.
Okay.
The official position asserts that the Iranian economy, through domestic production and maybe alternate trade routes, is resilient enough to withstand the pressure. This defiance is often coupled with the threat of maybe accelerating regional proxy activity or nuclear program advancements as leverage against international attempts to restrict their economy.
Wow. Okay. That covers a lot of geopolitical volatility. So we see this colossal ambition in finance running right alongside immense pressure in politics. Let's pivot sharply now to where that ambition meets maybe bureaucratic friction, specifically in technology and regulation.
Mm.
We see a really distinct contrast in how AI is being deployed between the public and private sectors.
It's a textbook case, really, of bureaucracy versus agility. The headline, U.S. military is struggling to deploy AI weapons, says a lot.
Why the struggle?
Well, it's rooted in a complex set of factors. You've got multi-layered ethical review boards, decades-long procurement cycles, the difficulty of integrating bleeding-edge software into legacy military hardware, and just the sheer inertia of massive government organizations.
Meanwhile, the article on Mistral, the future of AI development will happen. Inside the enterprises suggests the private sector, especially dedicated enterprise developers, they're moving rapidly, precisely because they face fewer of those hurdles.
Exactly. Enterprise AI development, what Mistral is championing, operates in closed, secure, highly optimized environments. They can focus purely on solving specific, measurable business problems, like supply chain optimization or complex coding assistance.
No congressional approval needed.
Right, they don't need congressional approval or ethical sign-offs for lethal use cases. This allows for quick iteration, narrow but powerful applications, and rapid monetization. It really makes the enterprise the true engine of current AI deployment.
The battle for consumer AI is also heating up, specifically between Meta and Apple. The question posed is, why Meta thinks it can challenge Apple in consumer AI devices? Where's the actual technological rivalry focus there? What's the battleground?
The primary battleground seems to be consumer AI hardware. Things like augmented reality smart glasses, sophisticated headphones, maybe future wearables that could even replace the smartphone. Apple traditionally controls this premium, tightly closed ecosystem. Meta, in contrast, seems to be positioning itself to be more open, offering potentially more integrated and powerful AI experiences across various platforms. They seem to be trying to outflank Apple by focusing on utility and broader device compatibility rather than just that luxury brand status.
This tech push is happening amidst some intense regulatory pressure, especially in Europe, forcing massive strategic shifts. Meta to launch ad-free service on Facebook, Instagram in UK. This feels purely like a reaction to regulatory demands, doesn't it?
It is a direct and probably very expensive response to stringent European data privacy regulations, particularly GDPR and subsequent rulings that restrict Meta's traditional personalized advertising practices based on user tracking.
So this is their way out.
Offering an ad-free paid subscription tier is Meta's attempt to establish a legally compliant alternative for users who don't consent to extensive data tracking. It's basically a financial experiment, testing the willingness of users to pay for privacy, partly to mitigate the risk of significant potential fines.
Turning now to corporate liability and resurgence, we see a major development for Boeing. Boeing clears key hurdle from 737 MAX crashes. After years of crisis, that has to be a significant psychological and operational relief for them.
Oh, hugely significant. It signifies the resolution of a major legal, regulatory, or maybe technical barrier that had been hanging over the company since the crashes, perhaps a specific liability settlement or a final FAA approval on a critical system update.
Right.
Clearing that hurdle is massive. It provides legal closure and a signal of returning stability. And that positive signal is immediately reflected in their order books. Boeing bags large orders from Turkish Airlines and Norwegian Air. That demonstrates renewed, large-scale market confidence in the safety and longevity of the 737 MAX X platform.
Meanwhile, other major corporations are still fighting for solvency and stability. The CEO charged with bringing Nissan back from the brinks suggests Nissan is still grappling with some long-standing structural issues. What are their biggest current challenges?
Nissan is still dealing with the fallout from previous leadership turmoil, definitely. Also, the global shift to EVs, where they've kind of struggled to gain traction, and an aging product line that just failed to inspire consumers in key markets.
So the CEO's job is.
The CEO's mandate isn't really for growth right now, it's for fundamental restructuring, cost cutting, rapid product renewal, and trying to stabilize that complicated alliance structure they have with Renault. The title itself tells you they're essentially in an emergency state.
In other liability news, Italy fines oil companies $1.1 billion in price fixing probe. That is a colossal penalty.
A fine of that magnitude really speaks to the egregious nature of the antitrust violations found by the Italian authorities. It sends an exceptionally powerful regulatory message about maintaining competitive markets and preventing collusion, especially in vital sectors like energy, where manipulation directly hits everyday consumer costs.
And even massive corporations aren't immune to persistent cyber threats. Jaguar Land Rover restarts some IT systems after cyberattack.
Yeah, a sobering reminder, isn't it? Of the constant operational vulnerability faced by all global manufacturers. The sophistication of these attacks means even companies with huge defense budgets can be breached.
And the impact.
The operational disruption caused by just restarting core IT systems translates directly into production halts, delays in the supply chain, and measurable financial losses until they get back to full operational capacity.
On the regulatory front in finance, there's a fascinating mandate. Banks ordered to dig through account closures to find debanking cases. We need a precise definition here. What exactly is debanking, and why is it such a central regulatory concern right now?
Okay, so debanking refers to banks unilaterally closing the accounts of individuals or businesses that are otherwise financially compliant.
Sure.
Often it seems based on non-commercial criteria.
Non-commercial criteria.
Right. Regulators are concerned that this practice might have been weaponized. For instance, there are reports suggesting debanking targets politically conservative organizations or cryptocurrency innovators or certain advocacy groups whose activities the financial institution might just disagree with.
So the regulators are investigating whether banks are acting as sort of ideological gatekeepers rather than just managing financial risk like fraud or money laundering.
Precisely. The concern is that if financial access is denied for non-financial reasons, it could violate principles of fair access and non-discrimination. It could chill free expression or prevent legitimate businesses from operating simply because they deal with a controversial but perfectly legal sector, like maybe high-risk geopolitical areas or cryptocurrencies.
Okay.
So the mandate forces banks to scrutinize their internal patterns and justifications for account closures to make sure institutions aren't denying essential services arbitrarily.
Finally, in the media landscape, Sinclair Nexstar will bring Kimmel back to their ABC affiliates. This seems like a key development for local broadcasting economics, maybe stabilizing a relationship that often feels a bit tenuous.
Yeah, this deal is essential for the economic survival of local television affiliates. Network shows like Jimmy Kimmel are major content drivers. They attract advertising revenue. They maintain viewership.
Right.
Securing this long-term arrangement ensures that key network entertainment programming remains a staple on local broadcast stations. And that's crucial for the revenue models of both the affiliate groups, like Sinclair and Nexstar, and the broader ABC network itself.
Okay, let's transition now to social currents, education, and the culture wars, a section often defined by these deeply felt policy disagreements and, you know, local battles. We start in Arizona, which seems to have become the epicenter of the school choice movement.
Yeah, the article highlights that at the epicenter of school choice, Arizona public schools battle existential crisis. This describes the profound financial strain and enrollment challenges faced by traditional public schools as massive amounts of funding get diverted into expansive voucher programs and charter schools.
Why existential?
It becomes an existential crisis because funding follows the student. If a student leaves using a voucher, the public school still has to try and maintain its massive physical infrastructure, staffing levels, but with significantly less revenue. It becomes unsustainable for some.
And we have a really surprising policy reversal that signals maybe a major ideological shift. California learns from Mississippi on phonics. That is genuinely shocking, isn't it? California, often seen as a national educational trendsetter, admitting it needs to follow the state, often ranked much lower overall.
It is genuinely remarkable. And it's probably a necessary correction based on the evidence. For decades, many progressive states, including California, embraced approaches like whole language or balanced literacy, which focus more on reading words through context and sight memorization.
Right. Mississippi, however, implemented rigorous, mandated, explicit phonics instruction, teaching children the sounds and rules of the alphabet first and foremost.
And the results.
Mississippi's literacy scores soared in the primary grades. It basically forced California to acknowledge that the data shows the science of reading, often championed by states sometimes ranked lower, is the only way to significantly boost literacy rates statewide. It's quite the turnaround.
That's a perfect example of policy humility, maybe driven by just undeniable results. Moving to public health, there's growing uncertainty around consumer safety, particularly concerning a common painkiller. We see two headlines: what we don't know about Tylenol and autism, and inside the crisis at Tylenol, what's the source of the corporate crisis management required here?
The crisis stems from mounting public concern and also large-scale legal challenges, suggesting a potential, though it must be stressed, scientifically unproven link between heavy or prolonged prenatal exposure to acetaminophen, the active ingredient in Tylenol, and neurodevelopmental issues like autism and ADHD.
So it's legal and public pressure. Exactly. The corporate crisis is multifaceted. They have to defend against multi-district litigation, manage intense media scrutiny, potentially negotiate with regulators over package warnings, all while the scientific data remains inconclusive. That creates immense financial and reputational pressure.
Providing a clear counterpoint in the health section is a reminder of established immunological science. Why vaccines work best when we're young.
Yeah, this is a specific medical detail emphasizing immunological reality. Basically, pediatric immune systems, because of their developmental stage and specific cellular structures, often mount stronger, more durable, and broader immune responses to certain vaccines compared to adults whose response capability might be more aged or compromised.
So it's context for vaccination schedules.
Exactly. It's critical scientific context supporting the efficacy of established early childhood vaccination schedules.
Moving to the opinion section, the intersection of religion and politics is addressed really powerfully. We see analysis of Charlie Kirk and the New Christian GOP, and Douglas Wilson wants the U.S. to be a Christian republic. Maggie is listening.
This analyzes the political solidification of Christian nationalism as a major, increasingly intellectualized force within the Republican landscape. Figures like Charlie Kirk, through large organizations, and Douglas Wilson, through theological writings, are providing frameworks for a movement that explicitly rejects the notion of secular liberalism.
And what are the specific tenets the article outlines that define this political push towards a so-called Christian republic?
Well, the articles explain that adherents advocate for the explicit integration of conservative Christian tenets into U.S. governance and policy. They're pushing for a system where national identity and law reflect specific religious values.
Okay.
This includes a robust focus on cultural warfare against secular institutions, arguing that the country must return to a specific, historically defined religious founding principle to achieve, moral and political strength.
In terms of political philosophy, another opinion piece argues the right needs to conserve free speech, suggesting that the traditional conservative value of open discourse is under threat and must be actively defended.
Yeah, this piece advocates for prioritizing free speech above perhaps other policy concerns. It frames it as the foundational defense against perceived censorship, particularly ideological conformity pressures seen as emanating from universities, digital platforms, and major media organizations. It's basically an argument for refocusing conservative energy on procedural liberties.
Finally, in fiscal commentary, we see analysis of a band-aid solution for our budgetary woes.
This commentary criticizes the use of temporary stopgap fiscal measures like those continuing resolutions to fund the government or short-term debt ceiling suspensions, which merely postpone a financial reckoning.
Just delays the inevitable.
That's the argument, that this avoidance prevents policymakers from implementing the necessary but politically difficult long-term structural reforms required to address chronic deficits and the looming crisis in entitlement spending. It's essentially a call for comprehensive long-term planning over political procrastination.
That brings us to our final section, moving from hard policy to personal finance, lifestyle, and culture. We start with financial trends aimed at the wealthy and the savvy investor.
Yeah, there's a fascinating specialization noted in the ETF market. Tired of paying investment taxes. There's an ETF for that. This refers to specialized exchange-traded funds designed specifically to minimize the realization of capital gains through complex internal mechanisms.
Okay, can you break down that mechanism simply? How does an ETF structure help someone avoid or defer capital gains tax that they'd normally pay when selling, say, a mutual fund or a stock?
The secret often lies in something called in-kind transfers. When an ETF needs to sell appreciated assets to meet a redemption request from a large investor, instead of selling the assets for cash, which triggers a taxable event for the fund,
Right.
they often transfer the underlying security itself, the stock, in kind, to the redeeming authorized participant. The ETF itself never realizes the gain on paper, and so the tax liability is effectively transferred or deferred. This maximizes tax efficiency for the remaining investors in the ETF.
Interesting.
It's a key advantage that makes these specialized ETFs highly attractive to high net worth individuals.
And the world of professional representation is catching up to the finance elite. Hedge fund stars are making so much now that they are hiring agents. This suggests the highest earners in finance are adopting talent management strategies we usually see in, like, Hollywood or pro sports.
Absolutely. When a hedge fund manager moves beyond just managing assets to managing a personal brand, which might include complex employment contracts, high-stakes speaking gigs, media appearances, personal investments, the complexity just demands professional management.
So they're talent now.
These financial leaders are now officially considered high-profile talent whose own time is too valuable to spend negotiating personal branding rights, hence the need for specialized agents, just like actors or athletes.
On the culture beat, we lost some memorable figures. Marilyn Haggerty, whose column reviewing the Olive Garden went viral over a decade ago, she died at 99. a true internet icon who really proved that authentic local journalism can still capture the national imagination.
Yeah, quite a story. And Jerome Cohen, the first American to practice law in China, died at 95. A real pioneer who helped bridge the incredibly complex legal and diplomatic openings between the U.S. and China back in the mid-20th century.
My favorite anecdote, which maybe tells us a lot about the creative process, has to be Matthew McConaughey's writing process. It involves tequila, steaks, and no cell service. I suspect that no cell service might be the key ingredient there, right? Enabling total focus.
That's likely the genius of it, isn't it? Total disconnection, combined with a very specific, almost ritualistic environment, the tequila and steaks providing a sense of comfort, maybe a reward designed for deep, uninterrupted creative focus away from all the modern distractions. It's intentional isolation for the sake of art.
Fashion is also defining status today, we read. What do royalty, Madonna, and Travis Kelce have in common? A love of fashion's most dramatic fabric. And if you need a clear status symbol for the winter, the $1,395 coat, that's a status symbol in the Hamptons and Aspen.
This really illustrates how fashion defines modern status. It's about recognizable, defined luxury items, and maybe dramatic textiles, perhaps velvet or specific silks are mentioned, that signal wealth and cultural relevance simultaneously. That $1,395 coat, specifically called out as a status symbol in those elite geographical bubbles, acts as an instant visible marker of affiliation and disposable income. It's necessary for entry into certain social circles.
Turning to travel, we see consumers kind of ignoring expert warnings. Experts say buy now, pay later vacations are a bad idea. Travelers love them anyway.
This speaks to the immense psychological pull of immediate gratification versus, you know, long-term financial prudence. The immediate ability to secure that desired vacation instantly, even if it comes with higher implicit interest costs or potential late fees.
Yeah.
That strongly outweighs the financial warnings for many consumers who are just eager to travel now. It's prioritizing experiential pleasure over maybe debt avoidance.
And finally, a look at consumption trends. We're seeing the extravagant loud candies adults can't stop eating in 2025. Sounds like a clear nostalgia play.
And also a concession to maturity. Too old or busy to risk a hangover, these mid-strength beers are for you.
The mid-strength beer trend is a brilliant piece of market positioning, really. It targets that busy professional demographic, people who enjoy the ritual and flavor of drinking, but absolutely require functional performance the next day.
Right. Can't afford the downtime.
Exactly. It acknowledges the life stage where the risk of a hangover is professionally intolerable. So it offers a responsible, moderate indulgence category. Smart marketing. We close today with an exhaustive look at the journal report on golf, which really covered everything from performance psychology to course maintenance. We learned that the key to playing great golf is being in the zone. Here's how to get there, focusing on that necessary mental discipline.
Right, and also crucial practical elements, like how golf courses adjust to a changing climate. This involves major operational challenges for the course maintenance staff dealing with things like extreme heat, water scarcity, new pest threats.
Yeah.
It requires significant investment in specialized turf and irrigation technology just to keep the greens playable. It's a huge undertaking.
There's also a call for etiquette refinement. Fellow golfers, it's time to get rid of the gimme putt.
Ah, the gimme. That's a perennial debate in golf circles, isn't it? The argument is that the gimme, while convenient in casual rounds, detracts from the integrity of the game, and it inhibits the crucial mental practice of actually putting under pressure, which is essential even in friendly competition. You gotta hole out.
And for the true enthusiast, what golfers should know about golf course maintenance, offering insight into the immense, usually hidden effort and horticultural science required to maintain those high-quality surfaces year-round.
Yeah, it really reveals the golf course manager as sort of an environmental scientist. They're managing water tables, turf diseases, soil health, often operating on extremely tight margins dictated by the changing climate and local regulations. Much more complex than just mowing the lawn.
So, wrapping up this really comprehensive deep dive, what were the major thematic threads running through the paper that seemed to define this moment in late 2025?
Well, we saw an intense tension across pretty much every sector, didn't we? economically, you have this huge American technological ambition seen in the massive AI CapEx race and that $50 billion EA deal, but it's measured against deep consumer anxiety, captured by the falling UM sentiment and the very different impacts of tariffs on big versus small businesses.
Right.
Politically, the recurring theme is the battle for the expansion of executive power, demonstrated most powerfully, perhaps, by the Trump-Comey legal cycle and that Supreme Court ruling on the $4 billion foreign aid impoundment. And that's set against a backdrop of increasing international isolation, evidenced by Netanyahu's deepening predicament and China's dual strategy for global influence. It really is this tension between high-stakes ambition and persistent anxiety that defines the day.
And what we hope you, the listener, take away is the utility of understanding these diverse connections. You know, how the political pressure on big pharma to offer discounts is intrinsically linked to the anxiety hitting Main Street, or how the private sector's agility in AI contrasts so sharply with the military's bureaucratic struggles. You should now have a thorough, synthesized understanding of the complex forces shaping today's world.
Exactly. And as we consider the, rapid validation and expansion of executive power validated by the Supreme Court allowing the president to unilaterally withhold $4 billion in foreign aid, it raises a really important question for the long term, doesn't it? If the judiciary continues to empower the presidency in matters of budgeting and foreign policy, especially when you set that against the deeply political use of the justice system we saw demonstrated by the Comey-Trump cycle, and immediate threats like the exposure of NATO's defenses, how will the traditional checks and balances withstand the inevitable next round of truly monumental international crises?
That is the powerful thought to leave with. Today's legal decisions fundamentally redefine the geopolitical maneuvering of tomorrow. Thank you for joining us for the deep dive.
A pleasure, as always.